True or false? Broadway musicals are lightweight entertainments meant to beguile the time of an evening and to leave people whistling a catchy tune or two on their way out of the theater. True sometimes, but not always, and particularly not since Stephen Sondheim came along. Stephen Sondheim is often called the father of the modern American musical. He earned the title by experimenting with form and content. He earned it by asking audiences not to sit back and relax, but to sit up and take notice.
You know, you're right because you want people to hear your work. You want people to hear your work and like your work. But if I have to take my choice, I'd rather have them hear the work and dislike it than not hear the work.
Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, two-time Canadian Podcast Award nominee and your self-described Sondheim expert. I just have a few things to go through here at the very beginning. The most important, I now have a Patreon page. I did have one for a while that was also tied to some other shows that I was doing, and then they stopped talking about it. But now, I have a dedicated page. There are some benefits that you'll get if you decide to become a patron, like the very first patron that donated to this page. Yes, it's already happened. So a big thank you to Eric Akawi for being my very first patron. Every level on the Patreon page will get thanked at least once on this podcast. Now, I want to be upfront. This show is always going to be free to listen to. But as it grows, and it is growing, it's taking up more and more of my time, and I would love to have it be supported entirely by the fans that are listening to it. So if you're able to help support the show, I'd be just greatly honored. If it's something you can't afford, I also understand that. You can help out by sharing the show with other people, because that goes a long way with helping the show find an even larger audience. Right now, depending on the level that you pledge at, you can find additional audio that myself and my guest this week recorded before the episode started. I've left a link in the episode description. You can find it by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. I also here, at the very beginning of this episode, wanted to read some listener feedback. So I got this email from David. You can email the show at puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. But this email is especially good because later in this episode, you'll hear me not be sure about when this change actually happened. So David writes, "I just listened to your episode on You Can Drive a Person Crazy, which was great, as always." Thank you so much, David. "You wondered about the scene near the end of the show between Peter and Bobby, where Peter is perhaps, probably, coming on to Bobby, who denies being gay, and then laughs off the whole conversation. It originally was in the script, but was cut before the show opened. It was then reinstated during the revisions of the mid-1990s. For example, it's in the script by the time Donmar Warehouse put on the show, with Adrian Lester in 1995. From what I've read, the point of the scene is to reaffirm that Robert isn't gay, since when Peter asks, 'You're not gay, are you?' he responds, 'No, no. Are you?' In fact, Sondheim and First Estate have refused to license the show to any production that wants to portray Bobby as gay." Now, I've already come out and said that I have never really read Bobby as a gay character before, but it's interesting to know that, at least according to David, that it is actually something that the estate of Stephen Sondheim is like, it is a no-go. You're not going to be able to do this and put on a show that leans into that too heavily. So thank you so much for writing that, David. I think that really does help flesh out this idea of how this show has kind of evolved over time. Now, I got another message, this time on Twitter, from the user mstonehennessy, who sent me a note explaining stuff about zombies. So, in last week's episode, my guest Christine and I were trying to figure out how much people in 1970 would know about zombies because of the line in You Can Drive a Person Crazy saying that he's like a zombie. So as it turns out, the people of the time probably knew quite a bit. So M. Stone Hennessy writes this: "Zombie, in this context, refers to the original voodoo idea of a person, living or dead, who appears alive, but has no soul. They're hollow and effectless. In 1932, there was a movie called White Zombie, and then especially there was this excellent film, apparently, called I Walked with a Zombie from 1943, which Sondheim would certainly have been familiar with. The creatures in Night of the Living Dead, etc., are actually never referred to as zombies. The term didn't catch on as a catch-all for cannibalistic revenants until Dawn of the Dead in 1978, which was retitled Zombie in its Italian release. Also, they didn't acquire their taste for brains until the spoofy Return of the Living Dead from 1985. And yes, you have stumbled across the rare fan of both musical theater and horror movies, which is why Little Shop of Horrors joins company in my top 5 favorite shows. So thank you so much for filling us in on that, M. Stone Hennessy. I think that kind of puts the right proper amount of context into that, where zombie wasn't necessarily the cannibalistic things we think of nowadays. It was more of this, it was more of like a soulless, like without feeling person. The last thing I just wanted to bring up here at the very beginning was my guest Matt this week was calling in with his phone. So you might notice a bit of a dip in audio quality on his end from time to time. Nothing that I think ruins the episode, but just be aware that I'm aware of that. Okay, I guess it's time for Plodding Along. This is the part of the show where I fill you in on what is going on with the plot of the show. After You Could Drive a Person Crazy, David tells Bobby that Jenny didn't like the marijuana that they had all been sharing. He strongly insists that he married a square and demands that his wife bring him some food. Thus ends that vignette. Then, all of Bobby's male friends converge on stage to tell him how envious they are about him being single. Each of them then tells Bobby about the perfect match that they have found for him in the song, Have I Got a Girl for You. Let's thank some sponsors, and then when we return, we'll talk about the song Have I Got a Girl for You with my guest, Matt McClendon. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by Inventures, a chance to connect with the best and brightest in global innovation. Join 4,000 plus creative and curious minds on the frontier of innovation. Hear more than 250 speakers on 6 program tracks, including Data in the Digital World, which I'm sure Brent Spiner will be presenting. Inventures connects entrepreneurs and startups with venture capitalists, angel investors, service providers, and thought leaders. The conference includes an education track for students too. Alberta Innovates is making all of this possible in Calgary from June 3rd to June 5th. Tickets are only $299 if you buy before the end of January. And if you're a student, you can get an early bird ticket for just $99. Again, that's until the end of January, so you can jump on that right now. Go and get your tickets today at InventuresCanada.com. That's Inventures, InventuresRes, InventuresCanada.com. This week, Putting It Together is also brought to you by Alberta Health Services, who wish to share this following message.
We ask these children if they know when to go to emergency and when there are other options.
I would definitely go to emergency if I broke my arm.
If you stopped breathing or something's really wrong.
If you had a cold, you should probably just go to a doctor and not into the emergency.
Or clinic.
If you have an emergency, we're here to help. If it's not an emergency, you have options. Take control of your health. Call 811 or visit ahs.ca/options.
Bobby.
Bobby.
Bobby, baby.
Bobby, booby.
Bobby.
Robert, darling.
Bobby, we've been
Bobby.
Trying to reach
Bobby,
you.
Baby.
Bobby, booby.
Angela, got
Robble.
Something to tell
Robert,
you.
Darling.
Bobby, honey.
Bobby, it's a Bobby. Bobby.
Matt McClendon, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you very much. I'm incredibly excited about this. I've been thinking about it for weeks.
Well, I'm excited about it too. It's always great to have like a new person join the podcast occasionally to, you know, offer their insight. And having talked to you a little bit before we started recording, it seems like there's going to be some topics that are going to get brought up that I'm excited to delve into. But before we get into any of that, maybe you can introduce yourself to the audience and tell a little bit about what it is that you do.
So my name is Matt McClendon. I'm a freelance writer and a podcaster. I live in Los Angeles, where it is unseasonably warm for the middle of November right now. It's 88 degrees here today, which is 31-ish, something like that, Celsius. Yeah. So I'm so excited to be here. I have to tell you, I don't know if you remember this, that I wrote you basically a gushing fan letter.
Yeah.
And basically invited myself onto your podcast.
You basically demanded that I had to have you on this podcast. And yes.
In a very polite Canadian way, you were like, okay, I guess so. Let the obnoxious guy from Los Angeles come on the show.
Maybe you can just describe a little bit about which podcast it is that you do.
Great. So I host, along with my friend Sean, a podcast called Warped, the completely unnecessary Star Trek podcast. It's essentially a comedy podcast that has light Star Trek theming as opposed to an actual Star Trek podcast. I always tell people that if you want a podcast where people actually talk in serious and thoughtful ways about Star Trek, there are lots of podcasts like that out there. That is not what we do.
Right.
We essentially are doing what you're doing with Sondheim, where you're doing an episode for every song. We are doing an episode of our podcast for every episode of Star Trek, starting in 1966 and going all the way through until they stop making Star Trek, which it seems like they will never do. So it's a Sisyphean task. We will never be done.
Yeah. Now, how do you address when there was simultaneous Star Trek shows on at the same time? Do you jump back and forth, or do you just pick one and go all the way to the end with one show?
That is an excellent question. My friend Sean, who I do the show with, will be very happy you asked that, because he is a little bit OCD and sort of came up with the strategy for this. And the answer is that we are watching them in chronological order. So when two shows are running simultaneously, we will be bouncing back and forth. We haven't gotten to that yet because we are done with the original series. We're done with Kirk and the Gang. We are now doing the animated.
I was going to say, I was hoping you were going to do the animated series.
We're almost done with that. We have a couple more recordings to do that. And then we'll be moving into the movie era and then into Next Generation. So if people want to listen to a bunch of dummies make fun of Star Trek, we watch the episode live. So it's a little bit science theater. We have it on while we're talking. So we're commenting on the things that are happening on screen. And it's a lot of fun.
I mean, we're not sponsored by CBS All Access, but I should say that if I could do math properly, either Picard will be debuting very soon or just did last week. It's going to be very close to when Picard has been dropped. So that'll be exciting.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. I'm really excited about that. This is basically my dream come true. I'm getting to talk about musical theater and Star Trek in the same conversation.
If only they could have done a musical episode of Next Generation and Sondheim could have written the music. It could have been this great combination of passions.
Don't say things like that to me, Kyle. I can't take it. I'm poor heart.
Well, talk about that. I mean, it sounds like you are a lover of Star Trek, but where did this love of Stephen Sondheim start from?
Okay, so I knew you were going to ask this question because you always ask it, and I had to give it some thought. I can remember as a child being taken at an inappropriately young age to see A Chorus Line when it came, the touring production of A Chorus Line came through town. And that's sort of the first musical I can remember seeing. But with Sondheim, I think it's Into the Woods. I mean, I'm of that generation that sort of Into the Woods was your first exposure to Sondheim, sort of kind of kid friendly. And I don't remember if I saw the PBS, the filmed version, but I know that I had the cassette. I had the cast album.
Oh, was that on that must have been on a double cassette.
I think it was, or maybe it was just a highlights cassette. I'm not sure, but okay. I know I had it. And that led to, do you remember the 92? We're going to be talking about Patti LuPone a lot on this podcast. Considering
sure.
Not really a part of this song, except a little bit at the end. But you remember the 92 Sondheim Carnegie Hall concert?
Yeah, for sure.
She sings Being Alive.
Yes.
So I saw that concert and heard her do that, which is basically my favorite version of that song. She blows the roof off of that place when she comes out. And to this day, that I think Being Alive is my all-time favorite song, not just Sondheim song. I think it's, I always say it's the best song ever written. And so hearing that song and hearing Patty do it, I was just like, what the, oh, can we swear on this podcast?
Yeah, you can swear. It's fine.
I didn't know if there were, you know, broadcast rules or whatever.
I just bleep it out with Patti LuPone singing a high note. So.
Perfect. Just like a high F. That's perfect.
Yeah.
So I saw that concert and I was like, I didn't know the show, but I heard her do that song and I was like, that's the most amazing song I've ever heard. So I like went down. I knew it was from something called Company because it said, you know, down in the captions or whatever. And I went down to Tower Records and bought the original cast album and fell in love with it. And that was it, you know. So that 1-2 punch of Into the Woods and then Company really just sort of set a course for the rest of my musical life.
Well, that's a good segue. I'm just, because not to put you on blast here, but how old would you have been in 1992?
How dare you? No, I'm 45, so I would have been like 18 in 1992.
Okay, so that makes
pretty, you know, pretty old.
I was just envisioning like an 8-year-old going down to Tower Records, being like, "Give me that original cast album of Company, my good sir," and then like taking off after that. But
yeah, on my bike.
That's right. But I guess like coming at it from a teenager, was it a show that you always like connected with, or was it something that you had to kind of grow into? That seems to be the recurring theme for a lot of people, including myself, where I had to actually grow into my love of Company. It was not an immediate one for me.
Uh-huh. Well, I think it's, I kind of fell in love with it right away, but I think that that's a couple of things. First of all, as a gay man who loves divas, Elaine Stritch is
right
all over that album. So there's that kind of aspect to it. And also, I think that those orchestrations, those Jonathan Tunick orchestrations, are some of the best orchestrations in musical theater history. That album just sounds great. So
yes, I agree with that.
I certainly was not sophisticated enough in terms of like relationships to like really get into the nitty gritty of what the show is about. But just on a surface level of these are great songs, you know, that was sort of where I fell in love with it.
Well, I guess today we get to speak about one that is a funny song, but it definitely is like not a serious one. I'm trying to say it's not a Being Alive. It's not the Ladies Who Lunch. This is meant for kind of like a comedy beat partway through the show. Have I Got a Girl for You, or Have I Got a Guy for You? If we're talking about the 2018 version, I just want to know, like, generally. Because I know that something that you said in one of your emails you sent to me is that you kind of just adore the husbands as characters themselves. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that a little bit.
Okay, adore is not the word. I think they are completely horribly disgusting and gross in this song.
Right.
But in a way that really makes me laugh. I mean, they're nasty in this song.
Right, yeah.
So that always really makes me laugh. My big thing about the husbands, and I don't know if you want to get into this now or once you get into the lyrics, but my thing about the husbands is I can't tell them apart, and I've never been able to tell them apart. Which one is Harry and which one is Peter? And is one of them named David? Like, I can never keep the husbands straight because they're so blandly written. Even in the book scenes, there's the guy who's a secret alcoholic and there's the guy who smokes pot.
But
other than their sort of one defining characteristic in each scene, you don't really know much about them. Certainly not the way you feel like you get to know the women. So I just think of them generically as the husbands, because the only one I can remember is Paul. And the only reason I can remember Paul is because Amy sings about him.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I kind of agree with you in the most part in that I always have to bring up the Wikipedia article to keep them straight in my head about which one Peter is and David is. So, and I think it's, I think you're right. I think they're underwritten to a degree. I do feel that when you see the show, it makes a little bit more sense. Like, you, but it's like, I couldn't tell you right now, gun to my head, it's like, tell me the difference between Peter, Harry, and David. I'd be like, nope, I won't be able to tell you. I'm sorry.
Right. I can't even remember their names a lot of the time. It's just Pot Guy.
Paul is the easiest one to remember, just because there is, he's mentioned by song, in song.
Why is there both a Harry and a Larry, Kyle? That's just bad, you know, writing.
Hey, let's just be glad that they didn't have a Jerry as well, just to finish off that triplet. It's a good question you bring up, Matt, and I wish I had a better answer for you, other than they're simply just there as kind of window dressing to, like, support the songs that Sondheim is trying to write about relationships and marriage.
The English major who likes to read too much into things is tempted to suggest that it's on purpose, that they're right. Intentionally underwritten because they're not, they're just sort of anonymous characters in what's really Bobby's emotional journey or whatever. That might be giving more credit than is due to.
Well, yeah, I think that the because none of these other people have any definable story arc throughout the show. It is really a Bobby show.
Yeah.
And even him, there's not even a through line many times, where it's not like he's starting here and you know, has to overcome an obstacle and then he has a realization at the end. Like, all that stuff happens, but it's not like your standard three-act structure show that we're working through either.
Right.
So we have these dumb husbands that get up here and saying, I guess my question here is this, is because I've always felt this song a bit weird in the sense that we have earlier in the show this really great song called Sorry Grateful that is like, that one, it is Harry. Harry is like vulnerable and talking to Bobby about what it's really like to be married and how you're always sorry, but you're always grateful. And there's this like outpouring of emotion there. And then here, a few songs later, we have all these husbands returning back and being like, hey, you know, just find a girl and get her in bed as soon as possible. It seems like this weird disconnect to me about how both of these songs exist in the same show.
It's almost like he knew, like he had already written this song, and he was like, I better put another song in there to make these guys a little more likable, or else it's going to be, the audience is going to turn on these people.
They're going to hate these people, yeah.
You put a much more sort of sympathetic song in there, so you go, oh, they're not such bad guys when you get right down to it. So then when they come along and talk about banging the girl from the office, you don't feel quite so gross about it, whole thing.
Well, here's how this song starts. It's basically a return of the very opening song of the show. And so I'm not going to mention every single person who's singing here, because that would just take forever to kind of go through all this. But so we have the company returning, and we have the classic Bobby, Bobby, Bobby Baby. Let me turn the page here. Bobby Booby, Robbie, Robert Darling, Bobby, we've been trying to reach you. Angel, I've got something to tell you. Bobby, it's important or I wouldn't call. What you doing Thursday? Bobby, look, I know you hate it and all, but this is something special. Bobby, come on over for dinner. There's someone we want you to meet. Bobby, come on over for dinner. The girl from the office, my niece from Ohio. It'll just be the four of us. You'll love her. I'm saying it that weird way because Sondheim makes sure to have like 13 O's in love in this song when he writes it out in his book, Finishing the Hat.
Bobby!
Bobby!
Bobby, baby.
Bobby, booby.
Robbie.
Robert, darling.
Bobby, we've been trying
Bobby.
To reach.
Bobby, baby.
Bobby, booby.
Angel, Bob, I've got something Robbo. To tell
Bobby, love.
Bobby, honey.
Bobby, it's important.
Bobby, baby.
Bobby.
What you doing, Bobby?
Bobby,
baby.
Bobby, look, I know how you hate
Bobby,
it.
Baby,
not love. That you don't know a lot of
money. Shows, but Bobby, come on over for dinner. There's someone we want you to meet. Bobby, come on over for dinner. This girl from the office.
My niece from Ohio.
So we have this return of like the opening song, which does show up multiple times throughout this show. Hey, you're in this English major you just said. Why do you think that Sondheim returns back to this opening refrain constantly?
Because I'm about to sound like I know what I'm talking about. But my guess would be because if you sort of accept the whole conceit that the whole thing is happening in his head, right? It's all sort of happening in the moment before the birthday party, or as some sort of reverie in his head during the birthday party, you know? Mm-hmm. Then it's just this sort of recurring motif where it's all, he's just, all of these scenes are, I think, supposed to be sort of happening in his mind, right? He's remembering right. conversations that he's had with these people. So it's just, it's almost like a mental tic where it sort of resets and takes you into the next thing, that I may have just pulled that, you know, out of nowhere.
No, I agree with that. I mean, there's different responses to this. I feel the more times I see Company, and there's multiple different versions you can see on YouTube right now, but if you look at it, it does feel like that is what's going on here, that the birthday parties that happen are like these snatches of what could be, and then these are like the remembrances of Bobby throughout the last few weeks or something, or at least throughout his life, about what he's talked about with his friends and other people, his girlfriends, that sort of thing too. So that feels right. It feels correct to me.
Yeah.
The one thing that is different here in this case is the line, "It'll just be the four of us," because I think that's in direct reference to the fact that in the opening number, it'll just be the three of us.
Yeah.
Where there, it's like, just coming over, it's just going to be us and our friends hanging out, or you can come and like spend time with the kids, you know, it'll just be us. And now this is no very specifically, we're trying to find you a partner. Like, that's what they're trying to do.
Well, some of them are. So the line right before that is the two lines right before "It'll just be the four of us" are the two lines that I think are really funny in this first section. The sure. wives want to introduce him to their niece from Ohio, right? That's
yeah.
somebody they want him to date and be in a long-term relationship and marry, right? They've mm-hmm. got a very different motivation for this than the husbands do. The husbands want to introduce him to this girl from the office. They don't even seem to know her name. And it just seems like they want him, and it's clear as the song goes along, they just want him to fuck this girl and then report back about what it was like. So the wives
they don't get to have that experience anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. The wives have this romantic thing of, "We're going to introduce you to my nice, sweet niece and you guys will fall in love." And the husbands are like, nah, let's come meet the secretary. You know,
right,
it's almost
right.
Mad Men-esque, you know, it's objectifying in some way.
Yeah, it is interesting that they don't even really have names. Like, they don't even talk about these people. It's just like, hey, she's a woman and she's single, so you'll probably have fun with her, I'm sure.
Yeah, you probably have a lot in common.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon. I'm gonna make a weird analogy here, but I mean, definitely for myself and other friends that I have that are gay, it's like, oh, I have a gay friend, you'll probably like each other. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
that's not really how it works.
Your straight friends are always like, yeah, I know one other gay person in my life, and so why wouldn't you date?
Yeah, that's right. It has to happen. Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure the wives know their niece's name. I don't think the husbands right. know the girl from the office's name.
That's true. Whatever, she's at the front desk. She does something, I'm sure.
Right, I'm sure she's, yeah. There's also, I don't know if you, I'm sure you noticed this, but there's a line in the recording that isn't in this book.
Oh, which one?
During that sort of overlapping thing, "What you do on Thursday, it's important or I wouldn't call," somebody says, and it's on the original cast album, but it's not on the Raul Esparza one, I don't think.
Right.
I just noticed it last night when I was listening to it. Like, for the very first time, I noticed it. Somebody says something like, "Not that you don't know a lot of people," or something like that, right?
Okay, interesting. Yeah,
kind of buried in the mix, and it was a little hard to make out exactly what it was that they were saying. "Not that you don't know a lot of funny girls, but somebody is definitely saying something like, we know that you know a lot of nice people," or something like that. Listen to it again, you'll hear it. "Not that you don't know a
lot of funny girls, it's good that you bring that up, because something I was going to mention is one thing I appreciate appreciate about Sondheim's book here is the fact that, at least in these types of songs, like, I have no idea what a lot of people are actually saying when I'm listening to it. It takes me, like, dozens of times to pick out, like, all the individual things sometimes people are saying. So, honestly, there could be someone saying something in that mix that I haven't heard, even though I've heard it, like, 20 or so times in my entire life.
Sure.
So as we continue on, Larry, now Larry is the husband of Joanne here in this case. He's the one who starts off. He says,
"Thank you.
Have
for
I got a girl? Yes, I'm going to let you know who all these people are." So Larry says, "Have I got a girl for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a girl for you, boy? Who, boy? Dumb and with a weakness for Sazerac slings. You give her even the fruit and she swings. The kind of girl you can't send through the mails. Call me tomorrow. I want the details." And then Peter joins in. Now, Peter is the one who is divorcing his wife and is probably gay. Yeah. "Have I got a chick for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a chick for you, boy? Who, boy? Smart. She's into all those exotic mystiques, the Kama Sutra and Chinese techniques. I hear she knows more than 75. Call me tomorrow if you're still alive."
Have I got a girl for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a girl for you, boy? Who, boy?
Dumb and with a weakness for Sazerac slings. You give her even the fruit and she swings. The kind of girl you can't send through the mails. Call me tomorrow, I want the details.
Have I got a chick for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a chick for you, boy? Who, boy? Smart! She's into all those exotic mystiques, the Kama Sutra and Chinese techniques. I hear she knows more than 75. Call me tomorrow if you're still alive.
So those are the first two sections that we have. I know it is.
It's
weird and disturbing.
It's funny, but it's gross.
Even this is like such a like an old person thing. It's like, who boy? Like even just saying that, it's just like, all right, like settle down. The fact that he thinks it's a positive that she's dumb has always stood out to me here personally. It's like, oh, she's like super dumb. You'll totally love her. It's like, I don't know. That just seems like a weird character trait to like lead with for me.
Well, and it's interesting, I'm literally just thinking this right now. It's interesting that he's the one who's married to Joanne, because Joanne's a lot of things, but she's not dumb.
Like, she's not dumb, that's for sure.
She's, you know, she's brilliant, you know. So that's funny that I never made that connection, because there are a couple of the women you could conceivably call dumb, and it wouldn't be incorrect, but... you would never say that about Joanne. So he's almost saying, like, I know a girl who is nothing like my wife. so maybe you'll like her. And she Sazerac slings, Kyle. We got to talk about Sazerac slings.
Yeah, this is my failing, is that oftentimes in musical theater, someone will say a line. It's like, oh, that's a fun turn of phrase, but I have no idea what it means. And then I never look it up to actually understand what's going on. So this has given me the opportunity to figure out what the heck they're talking about. a Sazerac. Do you know what a Sazerac sling is?
I knew that it was a drink, but I had never. I did not know what was in it, and I have never had one. So through
context clues, I was like, it's either a drink or maybe some sort of like, I don't know, tobacco or something like that. But I was like, I'm pretty sure it's a drink is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So let me tell you how you can make this if you are so inclined. Well, welcome to, you know, Kyle's Alcohol Corner here for just a minute. This is how you prepare it. First of all, these are the ingredients that you need. You need an ounce and a half of cognac. You need a third of an ounce of absinthe. You need one sugar cube and then two dashes of bitters. Uh-huh. I don't know what dashes are necessarily, but just a little bit, I'm assuming. Here's how you make it. So you rinse a chilled old-fashioned glass with the absinthe, and you add crushed ice, and then you set it aside. And then in another glass, you stir the remaining ingredients over ice, set it aside. Then you discard all the ice and any excess absinthe from the prepared glass, strain the drink into the glass, and then you add lemon peel for garnish. It's a bit of a to-do to get to this drink.
I mean, it sounds great.
I totally try this. Yeah.
I had thought to make one before we started. I could be sipping one right now. It's essentially, I used to bartend, but this is such a passé drink or such an old...
Yeah, this is like such an old-timey drink. Although apparently, according to Wikipedia, this is the city drink of New Orleans or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially an old-fashioned. An old-fashioned is whiskey and bitters and sugar. So this is just adds the sort of absinthe splash.
For aroma, I think. Yes. Now, here's my question then for you. This is what has to be asked here if you're a bartender. So if you didn't do very many Sazerac slings, how many vodka stingers did you make in your life?
That is another zero. I don't think I've...
Oh, no.
It's been a long time since I bartended, but I don't remember anybody ever ordering a vodka stinger. Except
I kind of want to go to a bar. Yeah, I kind of want to go to a bar and just ask for a vodka stinger and see if anyone knows what that is,
or if anybody gets the reference. You know, you walk into
it. I will assure you they will not, unless we're in New York, and then there's a good possibility.
I don't know. I think if you walked into the right bar, if you walked into
right.
We have some bars here that do, you know, like show tune nights and things like that. I think you walked in with the right amount of sass and loudly proclaimed that you wanted a vodka stinger, people would understand what you were doing.
Now, of course, Larry wants all these details, which again is kind of a weird ask for this like older friend of his. I always find that Bobby really isn't friends with Larry. Like, he's friends with Joanne for sure,
but
he doesn't seem to be like super like good friends with Larry specifically. Anyways, it's an odd thing to have this guy kind of telling him what to do. When it comes to Peter though, here, like bringing up the Kama Sutra and these Chinese techniques, whatever that means,
I think we all know what it means.
Well, I mean, like I know what he thinks it means. I don't know. I was gonna look it up, and now I realize I've forgotten to do this. I don't know how new the Kama Sutra would have been. I mean, I shouldn't say new. It's been around for like hundreds of thousands of years, probably at this point. What I'm saying is like how much of like the West would have known what the Kama Sutra was at that point.
Yeah. When did it become a common thing in America? Yeah. That's, I mean, it's gotta be the '60s, right? It's gotta be this whole.
Oh yeah. That would make more, the most sense for sure.
The '60s. It's gotta be part of that. Because so much of that was tied up into, you know, Eastern mysticism, and all that stuff kind of came as one big bundle. So
right.
That would be my guess. Peter is a little hipper than Larry. Like Peter's talking about,
for sure.
Peter's talking about the Kama Sutra. Larry's talking about obscure absinthe cocktails, which I guess makes sense because Larry's supposed to be the older one of the group, right? Because he's married to Joanne.
Correct. Yeah.
And you said something interesting that I just wanted to go back to for a second. When you said that he seems like he's friends with Joanne more than Larry, have you thought about which one he's friends with in each of the couples? Like,
well, sort of, but that's only because you get like those scenes in between the songs,
right?
And he seems to be friends with both the males and the females. In all the other, well, that's a good question. I would say that you've caught me. I'm going to go just to refresh my memory. So for Sarah and Harry, I think friends with both. For Susan and Peter, I think friends with both. But when it gets to Amy and Paul, it seems like he's more friends with Amy than he is with Paul.
Yeah.
Just with the very brief scene that they have together.
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell because Paul's barely in that scene. But yeah. I agree.
So, who knows? I guess we can create our own fan fiction about who's friends with whom. By the way, you were correct. Doing a very, very quick like overview of this Wikipedia article that I just went to, the first translation was like in the 1800s, but it didn't really become available, the Kama Sutra, that is, until the 1960s in the U.S., at least. So,
in the 60s,
we were right. Yeah. Free love. It sounded like a good idea at the time.
Have you ever heard or experienced anybody saying to you what Larry essentially says, which is, please go have sex with this woman or man or whoever, and then call me and tell me about it because I want to live vicariously through your sex life? That is a big ask.
Yeah, that does seem weird to me. And like, as much as, you know, we can talk about like locker room talk and all that kind of stuff, I mean, I've literally have never had a friend ask me to do that. Not even one time. I have never asked a person to do this for me. It would seem weird. It would seem odd for me to do that in any type of context. So, yeah, I think this is just like that pervy old man sort of thing that they're bringing up here.
Yeah.
Now, I always ask this. I don't actually think there is any deeper meaning other than he just needed a lyric. But do you think there is any meaning between I hear she knows more than 75? Why that number? Why 75?
I mean, it's got to be that it rhymes with alive, right? I mean, that's
I'm pretty sure that's the actual reason. Yes, that he just needed something to rhyme with that.
It's a big number too. So it's suggesting that this girl, you know, because he could have said 5, he could have said 25. It, 75 is a lot, and it's partly it's the rhythm that it needs that third syllable in 70, but it's. Yeah. And he's, you know, such a stickler about that kind of thing. 75 is a lot. If you know 75 different positions in the Kama Sutra, you get around, you know? He also calls her smart, but his definition of smart is knows a lot of stuff about sex.
Yeah, like really. So we have a dumb girl and a girl who's smart, but about sex.
Yeah.
So that kind of sums up about what these husbands are really, like, prioritizing more than anything else.
Yeah.
So what happens next, I just want to point this out. So in Finishing the Hat, Sondheim includes a whole long passage because in the original song, not in the original song, originally what he wanted to do was have this whole other extended sequence where the wives then came in and gave their ideas about what kind of girls Bobby should be going after.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to read that whole thing out. So Larry returns, good old Larry, and he says, "Dumb, and with a weakness for Sazerac slings, you gave her even the fruit and she swings, but if the thing that you want is restraint, I'll take her out, pal, and you can sit here with old paint." Which I'm assuming he is referencing Joanne as old paint. Jenny appears, and Robert goes to her and says, "Your hairdo looks great," and Jenny says, "Thank you, Bobby," and he says, and then David, her husband, says, "Your hairdo looks great," and she says, "Well, it should, it's a wig." Then Sarah appears, and Robert says, "You're losing some weight." And Sarah says, "Thank you, Robert." And then Harry, her husband, says, "You're losing some weight." And she says, "And I look like a pig." Then Amy appears, and Robert says, "That bracelet's a smash." And Amy says, "Thank you, Bobby." And then Paul, of course, her husband, says, "That bracelet's a smash." And she says, "It's not bad for a fake." And then Joanne appears, and Robert says, "That dress has panache." Joanne says, "Thank you, Robbie." And Larry says, "That dress has panache." And Joanne says, "Jesus, give me a break." The husbands are supposedly come back and say, "What do you like? You like laughter filling your days? Somebody on your side evermore? What do you like? You like constant showers of praise? Then what do you want to get married for? Look what you got now, an army of wives. Flirt with them and nobody will snitch. You're in their heads, buddy. We're in their lives. Listen, you fortunate son of a bitch." And then the wives take over and say, "Have I got a girl for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a girl for you, Bob? Oh, Bob. Chic. I never saw so much chic in my V," which is French for life. "I must admit that she's terribly me. However, somehow she's terribly you. Yes, dear, I know. But a young 42. And then the wives, overlapping with each other, say, "Have I got a girl for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a girl for you, Bob? Oh, Bob." And then Joanne says, "Perf. You've never seen so much perf in one broad. You'll have to curb yourself not to applaud. And all she wants is a man who's a man, tall, blonde, and rich, and her name is Joanne." So I just want to talk about this whole cut section because I find it, well, somewhat odd in many cases, but I think it definitely leans heavily into that whole, like, idea of, you know, the wives being like, I don't know, like the shrewish woman in the relationship and the man being like, "Come on, buddy, like you can live up in a single life. You don't actually want to get married." And it kind of just makes that point over and over again in kind of different ways. But I don't know. What's your reaction to that?
This whole section is a lot. Like, I am glad it's not in the song because
me too.
The song is short. The whole thing is only like 2.5 minutes or something. And that's just fine. Like, it doesn't need to be longer. It's kind of a one joke song. The husbands are gross and inappropriately sexual and they want to live vicariously through Bobby. Once you know that, the song is over because that's the only point that the song has to make. So having this whole extra section is just kind of making the same point over and over again. It's gilding the lily. Although I do kind of love Joanne describing the perfect woman, and then it's her. Like, that's the only part of that chunk that I wish was still there, because I that just really made me laugh. And I was like, well, that's the only good part of this other section.
I kind of agree. I think you cut out everything else. Leave that one part in there and then go from there. Sondheim says, like, the section was cut primarily for reasons of length, but also because it made the wives bitches and the husbands chumps, a danger in a show where the women are drawn more incisively than the men. In its final incarnation, the song picks up as follows, so you kind of see what the rest of the lyrics go as. But I think that's exactly what we're kind of talking about here, is like, in this entire show, the women get way more character development than the men ever do, which is, like, weird for any type of entertainment, for the most part. But also, yeah, he was treading a bit on thin ice here about, you know, walking into that gender dynamic that is so easy, I think, for writers to get into, where it's just like, oh, well, this writer like this and him like this, and that's how relationships are, type of thing. So I overall, I am glad that it's gone.
I am too. And I like that. I read that same note when I was reading this to get ready for today, and it made me very happy that Sondheim agreed with me and with you and with all of this, that the men are not well defined, you know, compared to the women. And if that stuff was in there, I think he's right. It tilts the balance too much against the wives, because the wives come off really badly in this song.
What I was going to actually start off by saying about this song is that it's interesting in that it includes one of my favorite Sondheim lines of all time. And it also includes one of my least favorite Sondheim lines of all time. It holds that distinction for me. And we blew past the one that I don't like at all, which is, the kind of girl you can't send through the mails. Call me tomorrow, I want the details. What is mails? Who says that?
That's an excellent question. I have no idea. I've never heard it anywhere outside of this song.
I even tried to look it up and see if it was like some old-timey way, or if it's like the how in Britain they say maths instead of math. Like, that's just a thing they say over there. It's like, no, I can't find any support for that take on it. I think he just needed something to rhyme with details, and he said, well, we'll just say males instead.
Yeah, that was my only guess too, would be that because he's older, that's some sort of old fashioned way of talking about the male, but I've never heard it before. So sometimes he wiggles things around a little. Strict as he is 90% of the time, sometimes you just have to stick an S onto a word, whether it belongs there or not.
I think this just shows that nobody is perfect, right? Sometimes it's like, you know what? I just need to have a rhyme here. And so I'm just going to have something rhyme. Okay, so let's get to the end of the song here, and you'll see if you can tell which line I like the most. The husbands come back and say, have I got a girl for you? Wait till you meet her. Have I got a girl for you, boy? Who, boy? Boy, to be in your shoes, what I wouldn't give. I mean, the freedom to go out and live. And as for settling down and all that, marriage may be where it's been, but it's not where it's at. What do you like? You like coming home to a kiss? Somebody with a smile at the door? What do you like? You like indescribable bliss? Then what do you want to get married for? What do you like? You like excursions to Rome? Suddenly taking off to explore? What do you like? You like having meals cooked at home? Then what do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for? And they kind of drift off into the distance.
Wait till you meet her. I got a girl for you, boy. You, boy. To be in your shoes, what I wouldn't give. I mean the freedom to go out and live. And as for settling down and all that, marriage may be where it's been, but it's not where it's at. What do you like? You like coming home to a kiss? Somebody with a smile at the door? What do you like? You like indescribable bliss? Then what do you want to get married for? What do you like? You like an excursion to Rome? Suddenly taking off to explore? What do you like? You like having meals cooked at home? Then what do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for?
Can you guess what my favorite line of this entire song is?
I'm afraid that what you're going to say is marriage may be where it's been, but it's not where it's at.
That's what I love. I think that's such a great way to phrase it. And I think it sums up the husbands so well about how they kind of begrudge it. Like they recognize that, you know, being in a relationship is hard work and stuff like that, but they also are recognizing that marriage does not solve all your problems. I don't know. I just really like that line a whole lot.
It's clever and it's got all of that stuff in it. It just makes me laugh because it is so dated. It's such a 1970.
That is true.
You know, the idea of the phrase where it's at or where something is at, like that's just something people don't say anymore. So to me, whenever I hear that line, I'm just like, nope, it's 1970 for a second. It clunks when the show isn't set in the 70s. It sounds a little out of place.
I mean, to be fair, I think that these last two stanzas actually make it seem dated even more. You know, like you like to have bliss, or you want to go off and explore. Well, you can't do that because you're married, because of the old ball and chain. Know what I mean? Take my wife, please. Yeah,
sure. And their description of what they imagine Bobby's expectations to be is a very kind of almost 1950s housewife.
Like, sure.
Cooked at home, and she greets you at the door with a smile and a kiss. It's like, it's Donna Reed, you know. It's just, even in 1970, that was becoming a pretty old fashioned way of thinking about marriages.
I just want to call out in the 2018 version, of course, they're changing this. Instead of "have I got a girl for you" to "have I got a guy for you," and it's Joanne and actually some of the other wives who are coming in and singing this song to Bobby. But the very end is what they actually do change a little bit. So they still do like, "do you like coming home to a kiss, somebody with a smile at the door? What do you like? You like indescribable bliss? Then what do you want to get married for?" But then they slightly change it. So what do you like? You like laughter filling your days, somebody on your side evermore. What do you like? You like constant showers of praise. Then what do you want to get married for?
What do you like? You like indescribable bliss. Then what do you want to get married for? What do you like? You like laughter filling your days, somebody on your side evermore. What do you like? You like constant showers of praise. Then what do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for? What do you want to get married for?
That's how they end it off. So they don't talk about Rome. They don't talk about some of this this other stuff. They slightly change that lyric. Do you like that better? I think that doesn't date it as much, for sure.
I think I do like it better. It's gender neutral. That could be the lyric in the regular version of the show.
Sure.
There's nothing gendered about it. So it just seems less dated, I guess is the word.
For sure.
I hope they just keep that lyric and just start using it.
That would be nice.
Forever. While we're talking about the new production, do you want to talk about Patty now, or do you want to do that later?
Why not? We're talking about it anyway, so let's jump into it. I know you have some you like some of the Patty-isms that happen in this song.
Yeah. Well, just first of all, just lyrically, the little changes that they make, like the person who is dumb and drinks Sazerac slings in the girl version is smart, but with a weakness for Sazerac slings.
So right, right.
I don't know why that got changed.
Have I got a guy for you? Wait till you meet him. Have I got a guy for you, doll? Oh, doll. Smart, but with a weakness for Sazerac slings. You give him even the fruit and he swings. The kind of stuff you can't send through the mails.
I guess you could probably make the they are a smart person, but they have a weakness for drinking, I guess, is
they drink,
what
they're
trying to say there.
Dumb.
But yeah, I guess it goes back to what we're saying here. Like, why lead with someone is dumb? I don't think that that's as much of a, I don't know, turn on nowadays than what it may have been, I guess, in the 70s. People in the 70s love dumb people, is what I'm trying to say.
Think about good old Suzanne Summers on Three's Company, you know?
yeah, for sure.
Oh, boy, Chrissy, look at that. I mean, aren't you glad we shampooed the carpets? Oh,
I sure am. I can't stand a rug with dandruff.
The sexy ditz is a pretty recurring trope. You know, Sondheim's used it a few times.
Yeah.
I was just listening to, I've been going back and listening to your old episodes, because when I started listening, you were doing Anyone Can Whistle, but I've been listening to the Forum episodes, and there's a classic sexy ditz in that show.
Oh, yeah, there sure is. Yeah.
And Joanna in Sweeney Todd is kind of a sexy ditz. And then the other change is the girl who's into exotic mystiques that's described as smart is described as smooth. when she becomes a man.
Have I got the man for you? Wait till you meet him. Have I got the man for you, kid? Who kids? Ooh, he's into all those exotic mystiques, the Kama Sutra and Chinese techniques. They say he knows more than 75. Call me tomorrow if you're still alive.
Do they mean smooth like suave? Or do they mean smooth like hairless?
He suffers from alopecia, but it's great. He's a great guy.
So anyway, getting back to what I talked to you about earlier, I am a huge Patty fan, as I know you are, and listening to this version of the song last night, she only gets that one little chunk. She sings the Sazerac Slings verse, and she does two classic Patty things that she always gets kind of dinged for. One of them is scooping. So if you listen to Have I Got a Guy for You, Doll, Who, Doll, instead of going, Have I Got a Guy for You, Doll, Who, Doll, that last doll, she goes, Who, Doll? Like she goes, she scoops up to the note instead of just hitting it straight on, which she does a lot. You can hear that in a lot of her songs.
Have I got a guy for you, doll, oh, doll?
The other thing that she always gets criticized for, sometimes I think fairly and sometimes I think unfairly, is for being sort of mush-mouthed and for not having terrific diction. She sings, instead of the kind of girl you can't send through the mails, the line in the new version is the kind of stud you can't send through the mails. I don't know what word Patty thinks she's saying, but it is not the word stuff.
The kind of stuff you can't send through the mails.
It almost sounds like she's saying stuff, the kind of stuff you can't send through the mails. Listen to it again.
The kind of stuff you.
And I know why.
I think maybe that's what I've always thought she did say when I've listened to the new version, to stuff through the mails.
Yeah.
But if it's supposed to be stud, then for sure that's not what it sounds like.
I hope you insert the audio of it.
Yeah, I will.
It is so obvious that she's not saying stud, and it's because she takes a breath right there. So she goes, the kind of stuff you can't send through the mails. And I don't think there's supposed to be a breath there, but
no. That's
what's causing the diction problem, is that she takes a breath so that she can get through to the end of the phrase.
Well, here, this kind of reinforces something which I know I've said in one of the recordings I've done. Unfortunately, because I've recorded these all out of order, I can't recall if this is something that I've already said or not. From all the reports I've heard of people who have seen that 2018 London version, they have loved that version of Company.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think whoever mastered or recorded that album did a disservice, because I don't think it's mixed very well. I think that they've put the voices way too up front, and then the orchestra is really too quiet, because everyone says, like, oh, it was so lush when I was there and it sounded great. It was like this full body orchestra. It's like, that does not translate across on the CD or onto the album. I'm old, so I just called it a CD. And which is unfortunate, because I think there's some good performances here and there's some good vocalizations, but I don't know if it was just rushed or why they released something like this, because I feel like everything sounds small, like even compared to the Raoul Esparza version, which is like famous for being like, we are really stripping this down, only having a few instruments. That sounds more full body than I find than this full orchestra of the 2018 version does. And I don't know why that is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that, but I'll have to listen to it again with that in mind, because that would certainly explain some of the vocal or musical things that don't sound quite right, you know? So that's interesting.
Well, there's two last things that I want to kind of bring up here. Sure. Here's the first, which is this leads directly into Someone Is Waiting. And I think this is the only time that there isn't at least a small break between two songs where there's like a little bit of the book that's happening or a dramatic piece. This is literally, we do I have a girl or have I got a girl for you right into Someone Is Waiting. And I wonder if you have any idea of why they decided this to be the one spot where it just runs into each other.
I have an answer, but it is not my answer. I have a book called How Sondheim Found His Sound by a guy named Steve Swain. Have you ever read this or seen this book?
I haven't looked at I'm going to let you and the audience know there's so many books that people have recommended to me about Sondheim that I think I'm going to have to take a longer break between this and Follies just so I can read all these books and just have that knowledge in my head. So
it's a really interesting book. The guy who wrote it is a professor of music. So it's written from a very music theory and musicology kind of viewpoint, which I am not a musician. So it's a very, it's a lot of it. I don't know what he's talking about, you know?
Right.
He does sort of write about the songs in a really interesting way, even though a lot of the time I don't understand the musical stuff when he's talking about harmonics and things like that I don't really know anything about. But he has this paragraph where he talks about this song and Someone Is Waiting. He divides Have I Got a Girl for You and What Do You Want to Get Married For? He treats those as two different songs because they're two different they're two different melodies, they're two different tunes. Right. He calls Have I Got a Girl for You an au courant jazz waltz, and then he calls What Do You Want to Get Married For a 1930s comic waltz that resembles the Arlen Harburg song Lydia the Tattooed Lady.
Huh.
Lydia, oh Lydia, say have you met Lydia? Lydia the Tattooed Lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus too. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia.
And then he says, lastly, an undeterred Robert pines for the perfect companion in his 1890s Vals Lente, which I probably pronounced wrong, Someone Is Waiting. This is the sentence that I thought was interesting. The music metaphorically accompanies Robert as both recede farther and farther from present-day realities into fantasy. So he's saying, like, the beginning of the song is jazzy 70s music, the middle section is sort of an old-timey tune, and then Someone Is Waiting is an even older-timey tune that is meant to parallel Bobby's sort of like mental state. That might be a little too, I mean, who knows? That might be a little too English majory, but I thought it was interesting.
No, but I mean, I could see that happening. I mean, Sondheim himself has said, like, yes, like he does have certain points to, you know, picking his melodies or the key signature that he chooses and stuff like that. But sometimes it's just happenstance and then people make up interpretations and he'd be like, sure, why not? If it makes it sound better, then let's just go with that interpretation of why I chose to do it that way. But I do like that idea because, I mean, Someone Is Waiting is basically him retreating into delusion of him, a thing he just needs to have like a combination of all these women in his life and then he'll be happy.
Yeah, you're doing a separate episode about that song specifically?
Correct, yeah. I have someone lined up for Someone Is Waiting specifically.
That's an interesting song because, yeah, like you said, it's a fictional version of all of the women combined together in different combinations, permutations. It's almost like, I don't know what the difference between Susan and Sarah is really, but he wants a Susan sort of Sarah. You know, like, again,
right.
Characters aren't so super well defined that you understand what he's talking about. Anyway, that's not my song. I don't know why I'm talking about a song that's not my song.
How dare you go in and try? No. The last thing I kind of want to end off on here is the recurring theme in this season has been really talking about Bobby as a character. And I would love to hear what your interpretation of Bobby has been or is. I have famously now said already that that I think that the initial interpretation of Bobby has been wrong. I because he is often described as a distant, cold character. I just have never kind of really found that or heard that, I guess, in the performances I've heard or seen. That being said, I want to know what your interpretations of Bobby have been, and also the interpretation that you think that Rel Esparza is not that great of a Bobby. So if you want to get into that.
Okay, so I'm assuming based on what you said earlier that you like that performance.
I do. I actually, this is my, I don't know, bold statement, is I wish that they could somehow make the original Broadway cast orchestration and then substitute Rel Esparza in for Dean Jones and keep everyone else from the original Broadway cast on there. I would think that would be an interesting, I don't know, experiment to see. But anyways, that's it. That's my interpretation. I'd like Rel Esparza's interpretation of Bobby.
Okay. I'm going to preface this by saying I like Rel Esparza a lot. I think he's a great performer. Right. I think the problem with his performance is that he was badly directed. Because I have a lot of feelings about John Doyle, who directed that production. And one of those feelings is that he had one really good idea and then just kept doing it over and over again. So
did you enjoy his like Sweeney Todd reduced down to like this?
Loved the Sweeney Todd. That's the time it worked. And the reason it worked is because the frame of it was that it was in a mental institution, right? So what you were watching was a performance. So it made sense that the characters were accompanying themselves. It all worked as a sort of thematic whole. People really liked that. And he thought, well, then I'll do it again with company. But I did not like it. I don't think it works. And I think that the problem, to get back to your question, which is about the character of Bobby, I think that Bobby has to be lovable. Right? Mm-hmm. We're constantly told these people are crazy about Bobby. I mean, literally.
Literally. Like, that's exactly what they say. Yeah.
They're stalkers about Bobby.
That's right.
They can't get enough of this guy. They literally, like, pull him back and forth across the stage. Yeah. I mean,
they break into his house and, like, wait with a cake for him and for his 35th birthday. Who does that?
They count on him to, like, keep their marriages going. You know?
Yeah, that's right. You're the only reason our marriage is even working, Bobby. You have to come over.
So for that to work, you have to believe that, right? You need an incredibly charismatic, likable, lovable Bobby. And I think that the way to do that successfully as a former is that you have to be very charming on the surface and let the depression and the despair and the sort of existential crisis stuff, that has to be underneath, and it can and it has to just bubble up every once in a while in the appropriate moments. And the problem I have with the way Rel Esparza did it is that from the moment he showed up on stage, I was like, that guy is seriously depressed. Like, he played it as someone who was really unhappy, like on the surface level. Unhappy. And I don't think it works because it doesn't make sense that the friends would treat him the way they do and would love him as much as they do if he's like that all the time. You know what I mean? Like, he's right. An
outer. So you're saying like the better way to play Bobby is then someone who is like this affable, like charming guy. And then in the songs, in the first little bit, that's where his like vulnerability and like indecision starts to come out. And then it's like he gets a little bit more frantic until like Being Alive shows up. Or I don't know. I'm kind of putting words in your mouth here at this point.
No, you're absolutely right. It all comes bursting out at the end, right? So he has to be constantly trying to keep that down, right? So he has to be superficially bright and charming and funny and the kind of person that everyone wants to be around, but inside he's having all of these like churning emotions. But Raul was playing it, and again, I don't think this is his fault. I think he was directed this way. He's playing it all out in the surface, right? It's all outward facing. So I just watched that show and I was like, I would not be friends with that guy if that's how he is all the time. Like, he's no fun to be around.
Yeah.
I
can see that.
The Neil Patrick Harris version is the version that is sort of closest to how I pictured it in my head, because he's very charming, and you know, you kind of understand why all of his friends enjoy hanging out with him.
I get inverse is the wrong way. I really like Neil Patrick Harris's performance as Bobby. I actually don't like most of the other cast in that version, unfortunately.
Sure, that's a different question. Yeah,
that's a different question, but.
But anyway, that's my sort of take on the problem that I had with that role as far as the production. Mm-hmm. I think
so. Then I guess for the gender flipped version, how did you come at that one? Do you have any like strong feelings about them having a female Bobby?
I mean, I'm fascinated, and I would love to see it. And hopefully, if I get the chance, I will get to go to New York and see it. But I don't really. It's hard to tell from the recording, you know. It's hard to get a sense of, because Bobby, the character is all in the book scenes, right? The songs.
I agree. Yeah, that's right.
Emotional stuff, but you get a sense of who he is as a person in the book scenes, or who she is. So it's a little hard to know. But I really like the casting. I like Katrina Link a lot. Mm-hmm. Did you see the band's visit?
I have not. I mean, I've listened to the recording, but I have not actually seen it yet. No.
She was amazing in it. So that sort of made me go, oh, okay. Because my first reaction to it when they first announced that they were even doing it before it started in London, I thought it sounded like a terrible idea.
Sure. And yet people who have seen it say it actually makes a lot of sense to have Bobby as a woman. It actually does kind of change the message a bit, but at the same time, I guess modernizes it a little bit more. I wonder how you feel, because what a lot of people have interpreted Company to be is that Bobby is this like repressed homosexual too. Have you ever found that to be true? I'm right there with you. I've never had that reading. I guess it's not necessarily wrong. You could make a version of that to lean into that a little bit more. I just have never had that reading of it.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of too obvious. It's less. Mm-hmm. It makes the show less interesting. It makes the show about a guy who's just gay and hasn't realized it or hasn't accepted it.
Right.
As opposed to somebody who's having a real kind of emotional breakthrough, which is a lot more interesting. And I think the real problem, I wish that they had never put that scene with, is it Peter?
Right.
I wish they had not put that scene back in. Because I guess the story is that scene, that little conversation about have you ever had a gay experience or whatever, was in the original, then they took it out, and then when, I forget which revival it was, that they put that scene back in.
I'm going to assume it was the 95 version. And I only say that because I can't speak, of course, to the original Broadway cast, but every other version I've ever watched has that scene in it.
Yeah, but it's not in the original. Like, if you look at the original script, it's not there.
Right.
Is it in the 95 or 96 one? Is that the one with Adrian Lester, the British one?
Yeah, it's been so long. I have a remembrance of it being there, but now I'm having doubts now that you're saying that.
Where's my Sondheim biography? I kind of think that adding that scene in, I know why they did it, because it was telling the audience, we're not ignoring the existence of gay people, right?
Right, so right, right.
The show is 100% straight down the line without that scene in it. And I think that just started to feel a little unrealistic by the mid-90s, maybe. So they thought,
sure,
let's put this scene back in. But I think it just muddied the waters, because then it's like, oh, well, he admits in that scene that he has had some kind of gay experience in his life. So maybe that is what the show's about. So I kind of wish they had just left the whole thing out altogether.
Well, if we ever invent time travel, we can go back and like be no and like jump in front of the proverbial bullet before they put it back into the show.
I'm going to write a strongly worded letter to Stephen
Bond. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come and talk to me about this. I know we talked a little bit about the beginning, but if people wanted to, how can they stay in contact with you online?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for letting me do this. I had so I had a blast. This is the most fun I've had in a long time. So I host a podcast called Warped, which people can listen to on Apple, iTunes, and Spotify, and all the standard places where you get your podcasts, WARPED. I always say if you like nerdy science fiction, gay things, and lefty politics, that's sort of the triangle of things that go on that show. So if those
I want to create a new podcast with that as the title, and then
you can follow the show on Twitter. We have an account on Twitter that's at Warped Trek, WARPEDTREK. That is the official show account that our producer Jake manages. My personal Twitter is at Host Warped, HostWarped, and basically I post about those three things: nerd stuff, gay stuff, and lefty politics. So follow me on Twitter.
Cool. Thank you again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening. You can email the show puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com, and you can follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can now support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thanks to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB and Ventures into Alberta Health Services this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so you never miss an episode. And if you are an iPhone user, if you can rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts, that is one of the best things you can do so that the show can reach more people. Next week, we'll be talking about Someone Is Waiting, and that someone is Jesus. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. For now, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now. I guess I'm assuming, have you listened to the show before or no?
Yes, I have listened to your show. That was why I wanted to be on it, was because I listened to the show.
What I like to do here then is to kind of give a rundown of what to expect here.
Yeah.
Just so that we are kind of all on the same page. Also, I'm going to be rude here at the beginning. I'm eating an apple too, so.
How dare you?